Not all of Anthony's officers, however, were eager or even willing to join Chivington's well-planned massacre. Captain Silas Soule, Lieutenant Joseph Kramer, and Lieutenant James Connor protested that an attack on Black Kettle's peaceful camp would violate the pledge of safety given the Indians by both Wynkoop and Anthony, that it would be murder in every sense of the word, and any officer participating would dishonor the uniform of the army. Chivington became violently angry at them and brought his fist down close to Lieutenant Kramer's face. "Damn any man who sympathizes with Indians," he cried. "I have come to kill Indians, and believe it is right and honorable to use any means under God's heaven to kill Indians." Soule, Kramer, and Connor had to join the expedition or face a court-martial, but they quietly resolved not to order their men to fire on the Indians except in self-defense. At 8 o'clock on the evening of November 28th, Chivington's column, now consisting of more than 700 men by the addition of Anthony's troops, moved out in column of fours. Four 12-pounder mountain howitzers accompanied the cavalry. Stars glittered in a clear sky. The night air carried a sharp bite of frost. For a guide, Chivington conscripted 69-year-old James Beckworth, a mulatto who had lived with the Indians for half a century. Medicine Calf Beckworth tried to beg off, but Chivington threatened to hang the old man if he refused to guide the soldiers to the Cheyenne Arapaho encampment. As the column moved on, it became evident that Beckworth's dimming eyes and rheumatic bones handicapped his usefulness as a guide. At a ranch house near Spring Bottom, Chivington stopped and ordered the rancher hauled out of his bed to take Beckworth's place as guide. The rancher was Robert Bent, eldest son of William Bent. All three of Bent's half-Cheyenne sons would soon be together at Sand Creek. The Cheyenne camp lay in a horseshoe bend of Sand Creek, north of an almost dry stream bed. Black Kettle's teepee was near the center of the village, with White Antelope's and War Bonnet's people to the west. On the east side, and slightly separated from the Cheyennes, was Left Hand's Arapaho camp. Altogether, there were about 600 Indians in the creek bend, two-thirds of them being women and children. Most of the warriors were several miles to the east, hunting buffalo for the camp, as they had been told to do by Major Anthony. So confident were the Indians of absolute safety, they kept no night watch except of the pony herd which was corralled below the creek. The first warning they had of an attack was about sunrise, the drumming of hooves on the sand flats. "I was sleeping in a lodge," Edmund Guerrier said. "I heard at first some of the squaws outside say there were a lot of buffalo coming into camp. Others said they were a lot of soldiers." Guerrier immediately went outside and started toward Gray Blanket Smith's tent. George Bent, who was sleeping in the same area, said that he was still in his blankets when he heard shouts and the noise of people running about the camp. From down the creek, a large body of troops was advancing at a rapid trot. More soldiers could be seen making for the Indian pony herds to the south of the camps. In the camps themselves, all was confusion and noise. Men, women, and children rushing out of the lodges partly dressed. Women and children screaming at sight of the troops. Men running back into the lodges for their arms. I looked toward the chief's lodge and saw that Black Kettle had a large American flag tied to the end of a long lodge pole, and was standing in front of his lodge holding the pole, with the flag fluttering in the gray light of the winter dawn. I heard him call to the people not to be afraid, that the soldiers would not hurt them. Then the troops opened fire from two sides of the camp. Meanwhile, young Guerrier had joined Gray Blanket Smith and Private Louderback at the trader's tent. Louderback proposed we should go out and meet the troops. We started. Before we got outside the edge of the tent, I could see soldiers beginning to dismount. I thought they were artillerymen and were about to shell the camp. I had hardly spoken when they began firing with their rifles and pistols. When I saw I could not get to them, I struck out. I left the soldier and Smith. Louderback halted momentarily, but Smith kept moving ahead toward the cavalrymen. "Shoot the damned old son of a bitch," a soldier shouted from the ranks. "He's no better than an Indian." At the first scattered shots, Smith and Louderback turned and ran for their tent. Smith's half-breed son, Jack, and Charlie Bent had already taken cover there. By this time, hundreds of Cheyenne women and children were gathering around Black Kettle's flag. Up the dry creek bed, more were coming from White Antelope's camp. After all, Had not Colonel Greenwood told Black Kettle that as long as the United States flag flew above him, no soldier would fire upon him? White Antelope, an old man of 75, unarmed, his dark face seamed from sun and weather, strode toward the soldiers. He was still confident that the soldiers would stop firing as soon as they saw the American flag and the white surrender flag which Black Kettle had now run up. Medicine Calf Beckworth, riding beside Colonel Chivington, saw White Antelope approaching. "He came running out to meet the command," Beckworth later testified, holding up his hands and saying, "Stop! Stop!" He spoke it in as plain English as I can. He stopped and folded his arms until shot down. Survivors among the Cheyennes said that White Antelope sang the death song before he died. Nothing lives long, only the earth and the mountains. From the direction of the Arapaho camp, Left Hand and his people also tried to reach Black Kettle's flag. When Left Hand saw the troops, he stood with his arms folded, saying he would not fight the white men because they were his friends. He was shot down. Robert Bent, who was riding unwillingly with Colonel Chivington, said that when they came in sight of the camp, "I saw the American flag waving and heard Black Kettle tell the Indians to stand around the flag, and there they were huddled, men, women, and children. This was when we were within 50 yards of the Indians. I also saw a white flag raised. These flags were in so conspicuous a position that they must have been seen. When the troops fired, the Indians ran, some of the men into their lodges, probably to get their arms. I think there were 600 Indians in all. I think there were 35 braves and some old men, about 60 in all. The rest of the men were away from camp hunting. After the firing, the warriors put the squaws and children together and surrounded them to protect them. I saw 5 squaws under a bank for shelter. When the troops came up to them, they ran out and showed their persons to let the soldiers know they were squaws and begged for mercy. But the soldiers shot them all. I saw 1 squaw lying on the bank whose leg had been broken by a shell. A soldier came up to her with a drawn saber. She raised her arm to protect herself when he struck, breaking her arm. She rolled over and raised her other arm when he struck, breaking it, and then left her without killing her. There seemed to be indiscriminate slaughter of men, women, and children. There were some 30 or 40 squaws collected in a hole for protection. They sent out a little girl about 6 years old with a white flag on a stick. She had not proceeded but a few steps when she was shot and killed. All the squaws in that hole were afterwards killed, and 4 or 5 bucks outside. The squaws offered no resistance. Everyone I saw dead was scalped. I saw 1 squaw cut open with an unborn child, as I thought, lying by her side. Captain Soule afterwards told me that such was the fact. I saw the body of White Antelope with the privates cut off, and I heard a soldier say he was going to make a tobacco pouch out of them. I saw 1 squaw whose privates had been cut out. I saw a little girl about 5 years of age who had been hid in the sand. 2 soldiers discovered her, drew their pistols and shot her, and then pulled her out of the sand by the arm. I saw quite a number of infants in arms killed with their mothers. In a public speech made in Denver not long before this massacre, Colonel Chivington advocated the killing and scalping of all Indians, even infants. "Nits make lice," he declared. Robert Bent's description of the soldiers' atrocities was corroborated by Lieutenant James Connor. "In going over the battleground the next day, I did not see a body of man, woman, or child that was scalped, and in many instances their bodies were mutilated in the most horrible manner. Men, women, and children's privates cut out, etc. I heard one man say that he had cut out a woman's private parts and had them for exhibition on a stick. I heard another man say that he had cut the fingers off an Indian to get the rings on the hand. According to the best of my knowledge and belief, these atrocities that were committed were with the knowledge of J.M. Chivington, and I do not know of his taking any measures to prevent them. I heard of one instance of a child a few months old being thrown in the feed box of a wagon, and after being carried some distance left on the ground to perish. I also heard of numerous instances in which men had cut out the private parts of females and stretched them over the saddle bows and wore them over their hats while riding in the ranks." A trained and well-disciplined regiment of soldiers undoubtedly could have destroyed almost all of the defenseless Indians at Sand Creek. Lack of discipline, combined with heavy drinking of whiskey during the night ride, cowardice and poor marksmanship among the Colorado troops, made it possible for many Indians to escape. A number of Cheyennes dug rifle pits below high banks of the dry creek and held out until nightfall. Others fled singly or in small groups across the plain. When the shooting ended, 105 Indian women and children and 28 men were dead. In his official report, Chivington claimed between 400 and 500 dead warriors. He had lost 9 killed, 38 wounded, many of the casualties resulting from careless firing by the soldiers upon each other. Among the dead chiefs were White Antelope, One Eye, and War Bonnet. Black Kettle miraculously escaped by running up a ravine, but his wife was badly wounded. Left Hand, although shot down, also managed to survive. Captives at the end of the fighting totaled 7. John Smith's Cheyenne wife, the wife of another white civilian at Fort Lyon, and her 3 children, and the 2 half-breed boys, Jack Smith and Charlie Bent. The soldiers wanted to kill the half-breed boys because they were wearing Indian dress. Old Medicine Calf Beckworth rescued Charlie Bent by concealing him in a wagon with a wounded officer, later turning him over to his brother Robert. But Beckworth could not save Jack Smith's life. A soldier shot the traitor's son by firing at him through a hole in the tent where the boy was being held prisoner. The 3rd Bent son, George, became separated from Charlie early in the fighting. He joined the Cheyennes, who dug rifle pits under the high banks of the creek. "Just as our party reached this point," he said, "I was struck in the hip by a bullet and knocked down, but I managed to tumble into one of the holes and lay there among the warriors, women, and children." After nightfall, the survivors crawled out of the holes. It was bitter cold, and blood had frozen over their wounds, but they dared not make fires. The only thought in their minds was to flee eastward toward the Smoky Hill and try to join their warriors. "It was a terrible march," George Bent remembered, "most of us being on foot, without food, ill-clad, and encumbered with the women and children." For 50 miles they endured icy winds, hunger, and pain of wounds, but at last they reached the hunting camp. "As we rode into that camp there was a terrible scene. Everyone was crying, even the warriors, and the women and children screaming and wailing. Nearly everyone present had lost some relatives or friends, and many of them in their grief were gashing themselves with their knives until the blood flowed in streams." As soon as his wound healed, George made his way back to his father's ranch. There, from his brother Charlie, he heard more details of the soldiers' atrocities at Sand Creek, the horrible scalpings and mutilations, the butchery of children and infants. After a few days, the brothers agreed that as half-breeds they wanted no part of the white man's civilization. They renounced the blood of their father and quietly left his ranch. With them went Charlie's mother, Yellow Woman, who swore that she would never again live with a white man. They started north to join the Cheyennes. It was now January, the moon of strong cold, when Plains Indians traditionally kept fires blazing in their lodges, told stories through the long evenings, and slept late in the mornings. But this was a bad time, and as news of the Sand Creek massacre spread across the plains, the Cheyennes, Arapahos, and Sioux sent runners back and forth with messages calling for a war of revenge against the murdering white men. By the time Yellow Woman and the young Bent brothers reached their relatives on the Republican River, the Cheyennes were supported by thousands of sympathetic allies. Spotted Tails, Brule Sioux, Pawnee Killers, Oglala Sioux, and large bands of northern Arapahos. Cheyenne Dog Soldiers, now led by Tall Bull, who had refused to go to Sand Creek, were there, and also Roman Nose and his following of young warriors. While the Cheyennes mourned their dead, the leaders of the tribes smoked war pipes and planned their strategy. In a few hours of madness at Sand Creek, Chivington and his soldiers destroyed the lives or the power of every Cheyenne and Arapaho chief who had held out for peace with the white men. After the flight of the survivors, the Indians rejected Black Kettle and Left Hand and turned to their war leaders to save them from extermination. At the same time, United States officials were calling for an investigation of Governor Evans and Colonel Chivington, and although they must have known it was too late to avoid a general Indian war, they sent Medicine Calf Beckworth as an emissary to Black Kettle to see if there was any possibility of peace. Beckworth found the Cheyennes, but soon learned that Black Kettle had drifted off somewhere with a handful of relatives and old men. The leading chief was now Leg in the Water. "I went into the lodge of Leg in the Water," Beckworth said. "When I went in, he raised up and he said, Medicine Calf, what have you come here for? Have you fetched the white man to finish killing our families again? I told him I had come to talk to him. Call in your counsel. They came in a short time afterwards and wanted to know what I had come for. I told them I had come to persuade them to make peace with the whites, as there was not enough of them to fight the whites, as they were as numerous as the leaves of the trees. We know it, was the general response of the council. But what do we want to live for? The white man has taken our country, killed all of our game, was not satisfied with that, but killed our wives and children. Now no peace. We want to go and meet our families in the spirit land. We loved the whites until we found out they lied to us and robbed us of what we had. We have raised the battle axe until death. They asked me then why I had come to Sand Creek with the soldiers to show them the country. I told them if I had not come, the white chief would have hung me. Go and stay with your white brothers, but we are going to fight till death. I obeyed orders and came back, willing to play quits. In January 1865, the Alliance of Cheyenne, Arapaho, and Sioux launched a series of raids along the South Platte. They attacked wagon trains, stage stations, and small military outposts. They burned the town of Julesburg, scalping the white defenders in revenge for the scalping of Indians at Sand Creek. They ripped out miles of telegraph wire. They raided and plundered up and down the Platte route, halting all communications and supplies. In Denver, there was panic as food shortages began to grow. When the warriors returned to their winter camp in the big timbers on the Republican, they had a big dance to celebrate their first blows for revenge. Snow blanketed the plains, but the chiefs knew that soldiers would soon come marching from all directions with their big talking guns. While the dances were still going on, the chiefs held a council to decide where they should go to escape the pursuing soldiers. Black Kettle was there, and he spoke for going south, below the Arkansas, where summers were long and buffalo were plentiful. Most of the other chiefs spoke for going north across the Platte to join their relatives in the Powder River country. No soldiers would dare march into that great stronghold of the Teton Sioux and northern Cheyennes. Before the council ended, the alliance agreed to send runners to the Powder River country to tell the tribes there that they were coming. Black Kettle, however, would not go. And some 400 Cheyennes, mostly old men, women, and a few badly wounded warriors, agreed to follow him southward. On the last day before the camp moved out, George Bent said farewell to this last remnant of his mother's people, the Southern Cheyennes. I went around among the lodges and shook hands with Black Kettle and all my friends. These lodges under Black Kettle moved south of the Arkansas and joined the Southern Arapahos, Kiowas, and Comanches. With about 3,000 Sioux and Arapahos, the Cheyennes, including Yellow Woman and the Bent brothers, moved northward, exiled into a land that few of them had seen before. Along the way they had fights with soldiers who marched out from Fort Laramie, but the alliance was too strong for the soldiers, and the Indians brushed them off as though they were coyotes snapping at a mighty buffalo herd. When they reached the Powder River country, the Southern Cheyennes were welcomed by their kinsmen, the Northern Cheyennes. The Southerners, who wore cloth blankets and leggings, traded from white men, thought the Northerners looked very wild in their buffalo robes and buckskin leggings. The Northern Cheyennes wrapped their braided hair with strips of red-painted buckskin, wore crow feathers on their heads, and used so many Sioux words that the Southern Cheyennes had difficulty understanding them. Morning Star, a leading chief of the Northern Cheyennes, had lived and hunted so long with the Sioux that almost everyone called him by his Sioux name, Dull Knife. At first the Southerners camped on the Powder about half a mile apart from the Northerners, but there was so much visiting back and forth that they soon decided to camp together, pitching their teepees in an old-time tribal circle with clans grouped together. From that time on, there was little talk of Southerners and Northerners among these Cheyennes. In the spring of 1865, when they moved their ponies over to Tongue River for better grazing, they camped near Red Cloud's Oglala Sioux. The Cheyennes from the south had never seen so many Indians camped all together, more than 8,000, and the days and nights were filled with hunts and ceremonies and feasts and dances. George Bent later told of inducting Young Man Afraid of His Horses, a Sioux, into his Cheyenne clan, the Crooked Lances. This indicated how close the Sioux and Cheyennes were in that time. Although each tribe kept its own laws and customs, these Indians had come to think of themselves as the people. confident of their power and sure of their right to live as they pleased. White invaders were challenging them on the east in Dakota and on the south along the Platte, but they were ready to meet all challenges. "The Great Spirit raised both the white man and the Indian," Red Cloud said. "I think he raised the Indian first. He raised me in this land, and it belongs to me. The white man was raised over the great waters, and his land is over there. Since they crossed the sea, I have given them room. There are now white people all about me. I have but a small spot of land left. The Great Spirit told me to keep it." Through the springtime, the Indians sent scouting parties down to watch the soldiers who were guarding the roads and telegraph lines along the Platte. The scouts reported many more soldiers than usual, some of them prowling northward along Bozeman's Trail through the Powder River country. Red Cloud and the other chiefs decided it was time to teach the soldiers a lesson. They would strike them at the point where they were farthest north, a place the white men called Platte Bridge Station. Because the Cheyenne warriors from the south wanted revenge for the relatives massacred at Sand Creek, most of them were invited to go along on the expedition. Roman Nose of the Crooked Lances was their leader, and he rode with Red Cloud, Dull Knife, and Old Man Afraid of His Horses. Almost 3,000 warriors formed the war party. Among them were the Bent brothers, painted and dressed for battle. On July 24th, they reached the hills overlooking the bridge across the North Platte. At the opposite end of the bridge was the military post, a stockade, stage station, and telegraph office. About 100 soldiers were inside the stockade. After looking at the place through their field glasses, the chiefs decided they would burn the bridge, cross the river at a shallow ford below, and then lay siege to the stockade. But first they would try to draw the soldiers outside with decoys and kill as many as possible. 10 warriors went down in the afternoon, but the soldiers would not come out of their stockade. Next morning another set of decoys lured the soldiers out on the bridge, but they would come no farther. On the third morning, to the Indians' surprise, a platoon of cavalrymen marched out of the fort, crossed the bridge, and turned westward at a trot. In a matter of seconds, several hundred Cheyennes and Sioux were mounted on their ponies and swarming down the hills toward the Bluecoats. "As we went into the troops," George Bent said, "I saw an officer on a bay horse rush past me through the dense clouds of dust and smoke. His horse was running away from him. The lieutenant had an arrow sticking in his forehead, and his face was streaming with blood." The fatally wounded officer was Lieutenant Casper Collins. A few of the cavalrymen escaped and reached a rescue platoon of infantrymen on the bridge. Cannon from the fort broke off further pursuit by the Indians. While the fighting was going on, some of the Indians still on the hills discovered why the cavalrymen had marched out of the fort. They had been riding to meet a wagon train approaching from the west. In a few minutes, the Indians had the wagon train surrounded, but the soldiers dug in under the wagons and put up a stubborn fight. During the first minutes of the fighting, Roman Nose's brother was killed. When Roman Nose heard of this, he was angry for revenge. He called out for all the Cheyennes to prepare for a charge. "We are going to empty the soldiers' guns," he shouted. Roman Nose was wearing his medicine bonnet and shield, and he knew that no bullets could strike him. He led the Cheyennes into a circle around the wagons, and they lashed their ponies so that they ran very fast. As the circle tightened closer to the wagons, the soldiers emptied all their guns at once, and then the Cheyennes charged straight for the wagons and killed all the soldiers. They were disappointed by what they found in the wagons. Nothing was there but soldiers' bedding and mess chests. That night in camp, Red Cloud and the other chiefs decided they had taught the soldiers to fear the power of the Indians. And so they returned to the Powder River country, hopeful that the white men would now obey the Laramie Treaty and quit prowling without permission into the Indians' country north of the Platte. Meanwhile, Black Kettle and the last remnants of the southern Cheyennes had moved south of the Arkansas River. They joined Little Raven's Arapahoes, who by this time had heard of the Sand Creek Massacre and were mourning friends and relatives lost there. During the summer, 1865, their hunters found only a few buffalo below the Arkansas, but they were afraid to go back north where the big herds grazed between the Smoky Hill and Republican rivers. Late in the summer, runners and messengers began coming from all directions looking for Black Kettle and Little Raven. Suddenly, they had become very important. Some white officials had journeyed from Washington to find the Cheyennes and Arapahoes and tell them the Great Father and his council were filled with pity for them. The government officials wanted to make a new treaty. Although the Cheyennes and Arapahoes had been driven from Colorado and settlers were claiming their lands, it seemed that the titles to the lands were not clear. By the law of the old treaties, it could be proven that Denver City itself stood upon Cheyenne and Arapaho land. The government wanted all Indian land claims in Colorado extinguished so that white settlers would be certain they owned the land once they had claimed it. Black Kettle and Little Raven would not agree to meet with the officials until they heard from the little white man, William Bent. He told them that he had tried to persuade the United States to give the Indians permanent rights to the buffalo country between the Smoky Hill and Republican, but the government refused to do this, because a stage line and later a railroad would pass through that country, bringing more white settlers. The Cheyennes and Arapahoes would have to live south of the Arkansas River. In the drying grass moon, Black Kettle and Little Raven met the commissioners at the mouth of the Little Arkansas. The Indians had seen two of these treaty makers before, Black Whiskers Sanborn and White Whiskers Harney. They believed Sanborn to be a friend, but they remembered Harney had massacred the Brule Sioux at the Blue Water in Nebraska in 1855. Agents Murphy and Leavenworth were there, and a straight-talking man, James Steele. Rope-thrower Carson, who had separated the Navajos from their tribal lands, was also there. Gray Blanket Smith, who had endured the ordeal of Sand Creek with them, came to translate, and the little white man was there to do the best he could for them. "Here we are, all together, Arapahoes and Cheyennes," Black Kettle said. "But few of us. We are one people. All my friends, the Indians that are holding back, they are afraid to come in, are afraid they will be betrayed as I have been." "It will be a very hard thing to leave the country that God gave us," Little Raven said. "Our friends are buried there, and we hate to leave these grounds. There is something strong for us, that fool band of soldiers that cleared out our lodges and killed our women and children. This is hard on us. There at Sand Creek, White Antelope and many other chiefs lie there. Our women and children lie there. Our lodges were destroyed there, and our horses were taken from us there, and I do not feel disposed to go right off to a new country and leave them." James Steele answered, "We all fully realize that it is hard for any people to leave their homes and graves of their ancestors. But unfortunately for you, gold has been discovered in your country, and a crowd of white people have gone there to live, and a great many of these people are the worst enemies of the Indians, men who do not care for their interests and who would not stop at any crime to enrich themselves. These men are now in your country, in all parts of it, and there is no portion where you can live and maintain yourselves but what you will come in contact with them. The consequences of this state of things are that you are in constant danger of being imposed upon, and you have to resort to arms and self-defense. Under the circumstances, there is, in the opinion of the Commission, no part of the former country large enough where you can live in peace." Black Kettle said, "Our forefathers, when alive, lived all over this country. They did not know about doing wrong. Since then they have died and gone I don't know where. We have all lost our way. Our great father sent you here with his words to us, and we take hold of them. Although the troops have struck us, we throw it all behind, and are glad to meet you in peace and friendship. What you have come here for and what the President has sent you for, I don't object to, but say yes to it. The white people can go wherever they please, and they will not be disturbed by us, and I want you to let them know. We are different nations, but it seems as if we were but one people, whites and all. Again, I take you by the hand, and I feel happy. These people that are with us are glad to think that we have peace once more and can sleep soundly, and that we can live." And so they agreed to live south of the Arkansas, sharing land that belonged to the Kiowas. On October 14, 1865, the chiefs and headmen of what remained of the southern Cheyennes and Arapahoes signed the new treaty, agreeing to perpetual peace. Article 2 of the treaty read, "It is further agreed by the Indian parties hereto that henceforth they will and do hereby relinquish all claims or rights in and to the country bounded as follows, viz., beginning at the junction of the north and south forks of the Platte River, thence up the north fork to the top of the principal range of the Rocky Mountains, or to the Red Buttes, thence southwardly along the summit of the Rocky Mountains to the headwaters of the Arkansas River, thence down the Arkansas River to the Cimarron crossing of the same, thence to the place of beginning, which country they claim to have originally owned and never to have relinquished the title thereto." Thus did the Cheyennes and Arapahoes abandon all claims to the territory of Colorado. And that, of course, was the real meaning of the massacre at Sand Creek. Chapter 5. Powder River Invasion. 1865. April 2nd. Confederates abandon Richmond. April 9th, Lee surrenders to Grant at Appomattox. Civil War ends. April 14th, John Wilkes Booth assassinates President Lincoln. Andrew Johnson becomes president. June 13th, President Johnson issues proclamation for reconstruction of former Confederate states. October, U.S. asks France to recall troops from Mexico. December 18th, 13th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution abolishes slavery. Lewis Carroll's Alice in Wonderland and Tolstoy's War and Peace published. Whose voice was first sounded on this land? The voice of the red people, who had but bows and arrows. What has been done in my country I did not want, did not ask for it. White people going through my country. When the white man comes in my country, he leaves a trail of blood behind him. I have two mountains in that country, the Black Hills and the Bighorn Mountain. I want the Great Father to make no roads through them. I have told these things three times. Now I have come here to tell them the fourth time. Makpualuta, Red Cloud, of the Oglala Sioux. After returning to the Powder River country following the Platte Bridge fight, the Plains Indians began preparing for their usual summer medicine ceremonies. The tribes camped near each other at the mouth of Crazy Woman's Fork of the Powder. Farther north along that river and the Little Missouri were some Teton Sioux who had moved west that year to get away from General Sully's soldiers in Dakota. Sitting Bull and his Hunkpapa people were there, and these cousins of the Oglalas sent emissaries down for a big sun dance, the annual religious renewal of the Tetons. While the sun dance was in progress, the Cheyennes held their medicine arrows ceremony, which lasted 4 days. The arrow keeper unwrapped the 4 secret arrows from their coyote fur bag, and all the males in the tribe passed by to make an offering and pray to the arrows. Black Bear, one of the leading chiefs of the northern Arapahoes, decided to take his people west to Tongue River. He invited some of the southern Arapahoes, who had come north after Sand Creek, to go with them. They would set up a village on the Tongue, he said, and have many hunts and dances before the coming of the cold moons. And so, by late August 1865, the tribes in the Powder River country were scattered from the Bighorns on the west to the Black Hills on the east. They were so sure of the country's impregnability that most of them were skeptical when they first began hearing rumors of soldiers coming at them from 4 directions. 3 of the soldier columns were under command of General Patrick E. Connor, who had transferred from Utah in May to fight Indians along the Platte route. In 1863, Star Chief Connor had surrounded a camp of Paiutes on Bear River and butchered 278 of them. For this he was hailed by the white men as a brave defender of the frontier from the red foe. In July 1865, Connor announced that the Indians north of the Platte must be hunted like wolves, and he began organizing 3 columns of soldiers for an invasion of the Powder River country. 1 column under Colonel Nelson Cole would march from Nebraska to the Black Hills of Dakota. A 2nd column under Colonel Samuel Walker would move straight north from Fort Laramie to link up with Cole in the Black Hills. The 3rd column, with Connor himself in command, would head in a northwesterly direction along the Bozeman Road toward Montana. General Connor thus hoped to trap the Indians between his column and the combined forces of Cole and Walker. He warned his officers to accept no overtures of peace from the Indians, and ordered bluntly, attack and kill every male Indian over 12 years of age. Early in August, the 3 columns were set in motion. If everything went according to plan, they would rendezvous about September 1st on Rosebud River, in the heart of hostile Indian country. A 4th column, which had no connection with Connor's expeditions, was also approaching the Powder River country from the east. Organized by a civilian, James A. Sawyers, to open a new overland route, this column had no objective other than to reach the Montana gold fields. Because Sawyers knew that he would be trespassing on Indian treaty lands, he expected resistance, and therefore had obtained 2 companies of infantrymen to escort his group of 73 gold seekers and 80 wagons of supplies. It was about August 14th or 15th when the Sioux and Cheyennes who were camped along the Powder first learned of Sawyers's approaching train. "Our hunters rode into camp much excited," George Bent recalled afterward, "and said soldiers were up the river. Our village crier, a man named Bull Bear, mounted and rode about our camp, crying that soldiers were coming. Red Cloud got in his herd and mounted and rode through the Sioux camp, crying the same thing for the Sioux. Everybody ran for ponies. At such times, a man always took any pony he wanted. If the pony was killed in the fight, the rider did not have to pay its owner for it, but everything the rider captured in battle belonged to the owner of the pony he rode. When all were mounted, we rode up the Powder about 15 miles, where we came upon the Sawyers' road-building party, a big train of emigrants moving along with soldiers marching on each side of it. As part of their booty taken during the Platte Bridge fight, the Indians had brought back some army uniforms and bugles. On leaving camp, George Bent hastily donned an officer's blouse, and his brother Charlie carried along a bugle. They thought these things might mystify the soldiers and make them jumpy. About 500 Sioux and Cheyennes were in the war party, and both Red Cloud and Dull Knife went along. The chiefs were very angry that soldiers had come into their country without asking permission. When they first sighted the wagon train, it was moving along between two hills with a herd of about 300 cattle in the rear. The Indians divided and spread out along opposite ridges, and at a signal began firing upon the soldier escorts. In a few minutes the train formed in a circular corral, with the cattle herded inside, and the wagon wheels interlocked. For 2 or 3 hours the warriors amused themselves by creeping down gullies and suddenly opening fire at close range. A few of the more daring riders galloped in close, circled the wagons, and then swept out of range. After the soldiers started firing their two howitzers, the warriors kept behind little hillocks, uttering war cries and insulting the soldiers. Charlie Bent blew his bugle several times and shouted all the Anglo-Saxon profanity he could remember hearing around his father's trading post. "They taunted us in a most aggravating manner," one of the besieged gold-seekers said afterward. "Some few of them could speak enough English to call us all the vile names imaginable." The wagon train could not move, but neither could the Indians get at it. About midday, to end the stalemate, the chiefs ordered a white flag hoisted. A few minutes later, a man in buckskins came riding out of the wagon corral. Because the Bent brothers could speak English, they were sent down to meet the emissary. The man was a good-humored Mexican, Juan Suse, and he was as much surprised by the Bent's English as he was by George's blue uniform blouse. Suse, who knew little English, had to use sign language, but he managed to make them understand that the commander of the wagon train was willing to parley with the Indian chiefs. A meeting was quickly arranged, the Bents becoming interpreters now for Red Cloud and Dull Knife. Colonel Sawyers and Captain George Williford came out from the corral with a small escort. Colonel Sawyers's title was honorary, but he considered himself in command of the wagon train. Captain Williford's title was genuine. His two companies of soldiers were galvanized Yankees, former Confederate prisoners of war. Williford's nerves were on edge. He was unsure of his men, unsure of his authority on the expedition. He glared at the blue uniform coat worn by the half-breed Cheyenne interpreter, George Bent. When Red Cloud demanded an explanation for the presence of soldiers in the Indians' country, Captain Williford replied by asking why the Indians had attacked peaceful white men. Charlie Bent, still embittered by memories of Sand Creek, told Williford that the Cheyennes would fight all white men until the government hanged Colonel Chivington. Sawyers protested that he had not come to fight Indians. He was seeking a short route to the Montana gold fields, and only wanted to pass through the country. "I interpreted to the chiefs," George Bent said afterward, and Red Cloud replied if the whites would go clear out of his country and make no roads, it was all right. Dull Knife said the same for the Cheyennes. Then both chiefs said for the officer, Williford, to take the train due west from this place, then turn north, and when he had passed the Bighorn Mountains he would be out of their country. Sawyers again protested. To follow such a route would take him too far out of his way. He said he wanted to move north along the Powder River Valley to find a fort that General Connor was building there. This was the first news that Red Cloud and Dull Knife had heard of General Connor and his invasion. They expressed surprise and anger that soldiers would dare build a fort in the heart of their hunting grounds. Seeing that the chiefs were growing hostile, Sawyers quickly offered them a wagon load of goods—flour, sugar, coffee, and tobacco. Red Cloud suggested that gunpowder, shot, and caps be added to the list, but Captain Williford objected strongly. In fact, the military officer was opposed to giving the Indians anything. Finally, the chiefs agreed to accept a full wagon load of flour, sugar, coffee, and tobacco in exchange for granting permission for the train to move to Powder River. "The officer told me," George Bent later said, "to hold the Indians back away from the train and he would unload the goods on the ground. He wanted to go onto the river and camp. This was at noon. After he reached the river and corralled his train there, another lot of Sioux came up from the village. The wagon load of goods had already been divided by the first party of Indians, so these newcomers demanded more goods, and when the officer refused, they began firing on the corral. This second band of Sioux harassed Sawyers and Williford for several days, but Red Cloud and Dull Knife and their warriors took no part in it. They moved on up the valley to see if there was anything to the rumors of soldiers building a fort on the Powder. In the meantime, Star Chief Connor had started construction of a stockade about 60 miles south of the Crazy Woman's Fork of the Powder, and named it in honor of himself, Fort Connor. With Connor's column was a company of Pawnee scouts under command of Captain Frank North. The Pawnees were old tribal enemies of the Sioux, Cheyennes, and Arapahoes, and they had been enlisted for the campaign at regular cavalryman's pay. While the soldiers cut logs for Connor's stockade, the Pawnees scouted the area in search of their enemies. On August 16th, they sighted a small party of Cheyennes approaching from the south. With them was Charlie Bent's mother, Yellow Woman. She was riding with four men slightly in advance of the main party, and when she first saw the Pawnees on a low hill, she thought they were Cheyennes or Sioux. The Pawnees signaled with their blankets that they were friends, and the Cheyennes moved on toward them, suspecting no danger. When the Cheyennes came close to the hill, the Pawnees suddenly attacked them. And so Yellow Woman, who had left William Bent because he was a member of the white race, died at the hands of a mercenary of her own race. On that day her son Charlie was only a few miles to the east with Dull Knife's warriors, returning from the siege of Sawyers' wagon train. On August 22nd, General Connor decided that the stockade on the Powder was strong enough to be held by one cavalry company. Leaving most of his supplies there, he started with the remainder of his column on a forced march toward the Tongue River Valley in search of any large concentrations of Indian lodges that his scouts might find. Had he moved north along the Powder, he would have found thousands of Indians eager for a fight, Red Cloud's and Dull Knife's warriors who were out searching for Connor's soldiers. About a week after Connor's column left the Powder, a Cheyenne warrior named Little Horse was traveling across this same country with his wife and young son. Little Horse's wife was an Arapaho woman, and they were making a summer visit to see her relatives at Black Bear's Arapaho camp on Tongue River. Along the way, one day, a pack on his wife's horse got loose. When she dismounted to tighten it, she happened to glance back across a ridge. A file of mounted men was coming along the trail far behind them. "Look over there," she called to Little Horse. "They're soldiers," Little Horse cried. "Hurry!" As soon as they were over the next hill and out of view of the soldiers, they turned off the trail. Little Horse cut loose the travois which his young son was riding, took the boy on behind him, and they rode fast, straight across country for Black Bear's camp. They came galloping in, disturbing the peaceful village of 250 lodges pitched on a mesa above the river. The Arapahoes were rich in ponies that year. 3,000 were corralled along the stream. None of the Arapahoes believed that soldiers could be within hundreds of miles, and when Little Horse's wife tried to get the crier to warn the people, he said, "Little Horse has made a mistake. He just saw some Indians coming over the trail and nothing more." Certain that the horsemen they had seen were soldiers, Little Horse and his wife hurried on to find her relatives. Her brother, Panther, was resting in front of his teepee, and they told him that soldiers were coming and that he had better move out in a hurry. "Pack up whatever you wish to take along," Little Horse said. "We must go tonight." Panther laughed at his Cheyenne brother-in-law. "You're always getting frightened and making mistakes about things," he said. "You saw nothing but some buffalo." "Very well," Little Horse replied. "You need not go unless you want to, but we shall go tonight." His wife managed to persuade some of her other relatives to pack up, and before nightfall they left the village and moved several miles down the Tongue. Early the next morning, Star Chief Connor's soldiers attacked the Arapaho camp. By chance, a warrior who had taken one of his racehorses out for a run happened to see the troops assembling behind a ridge. He galloped back to camp as fast as he could, giving some of the Arapahoes a chance to flee down the river. A few moments later, at the sound of a bugle and the blast of a howitzer, 80 Pawnee scouts and 250 of Connor's cavalrymen charged the village from two sides. The Pawnees swerved toward the 3,000 ponies which the Arapaho herders were desperately trying to scatter along the river valley. The village, which had been peaceful and quiet a few minutes before, suddenly became a scene of fearful tumult. Horses rearing and whinnying, dogs barking, women screaming, children crying, warriors and soldiers yelling and cursing. The Arapahoes tried to form a line of defense to screen the flight of their non-combatants, but in the first rattle of rifle fire, some women and children were caught between the warriors and the cavalrymen. "The troops," said one of Connor's officers, "killed a warrior who, falling from his horse, dropped two Indian children he had been carrying. In retreating, the Indians left the children about halfway between the two lines, where they could not be reached by either party." The children were shot down. "I was in the village in the midst of a hand-to-hand fight with warriors and their squaws," another officer said, "for many of the female portion of this band did as brave fighting as their savage lords. Unfortunately for the women and children, our men had no time to direct their aim. Squaws and children, as well as warriors, fell among the dead and wounded." As quickly as they could catch ponies, the Arapahoes mounted and began retreating up Wolf Creek, the soldiers pressing after them. With the soldiers was a scout in buckskins, and some of the older Arapahoes recognized him as an old acquaintance who had trapped along the Tongue and Powder years before and had married one of their women. They had considered him a friend. Blanket, they called him, Blanket Jim Bridger. Now he was a mercenary like the Pawnees. For 10 miles the Arapahoes retreated that day, and when the soldiers' horses grew tired, the warriors turned on them, using their old trade guns upon the bluecoats and stinging them with arrows. By early afternoon, Black Bear and his warriors pushed Connor's cavalrymen back to the village, but artillerymen had mounted two howitzers there, and the big talking guns filled the air with whistling pieces of metal. The Arapahoes could go no farther. While the Arapahoes watched from the hills, the soldiers tore down all the lodges in the village and heaped poles, teepee covers, buffalo robes, blankets, furs, and 30 tons of pemmican into great mounds and set fire to them. Everything the Arapahoes owned—shelter, clothing, and their winter supply of food—went up in smoke. And then the soldiers and the Pawnees mounted up and went away with the ponies they had captured, 1,000 animals, 1/3 of the tribe's pony herd. During the afternoon, Little Horse, the Cheyenne who had tried to warn the Arapahoes that soldiers were coming, heard the sound of the big guns. As soon as the soldiers left, he and his wife and those of her relatives who had heeded their warning came back into the burned village. They found more than 50 dead Indians. Panther, Little Horse's brother-in-law, was lying beside a circle of yellowed grass where his lodge had stood that morning. Many others, including Black Bear's son, were badly wounded and soon would die. The Arapahoes had nothing left except the ponies they had saved from capture, a few old guns, their bows and arrows, and the clothing they were wearing when the soldiers charged into the village. This was the Battle of Tongue River that happened in the moon when the geese shed their feathers. Next morning, some of the warriors followed after Connor's cavalrymen, who were heading north toward the Rosebud. On that same day, the Sawyer's wagon train, which the Sioux and Cheyennes had besieged 2 weeks earlier, came rolling through the Arapaho country. Infuriated by the presence of so many intruders, the Indians ambushed soldiers scouting ahead of the train, stampeded cattle in the rear, and picked off an occasional wagon driver. Because they had expended most of their ammunition fighting Connor's cavalrymen, the Arapahoes were not strong enough to surround and attack Sawyer's wagons. They constantly harassed the gold seekers, however, until they passed out of the Bighorn country into Montana. Star Chief Connor, meanwhile, marched on toward the Rosebud, searching hungrily for more Indian villages to destroy. As he neared the rendezvous point on the Rosebud, he sent scouts out in all directions to look for the other two columns of his expedition, the ones led by the Eagle Chiefs, Cole and Walker. No trace could be found of either column, and they were a week overdue. On September 9th, Connor ordered Captain North to lead his Pawnees in a forced march to Powder River in hopes of intercepting the columns. On the second day, the Pawnee mercenaries ran into a blinding sleet storm, and then 2 days later they found where Cole and Walker had camped not long before. The ground was covered with dead horses, 900 of them. The Pawnees were overcome with astonishment and wonder at the sight, for they did not know how the animals had come to their deaths. Many of the horses had been shot through the head. Nearby were charred remains in which they found pieces of metal buckles, stirrups, and rings, the remains of burned saddles and harnesses. Captain North was uncertain what to make of this evidence of a disaster. He immediately turned back toward the Rosebud to report to General Connor. On August 18th, the two columns under Cole and Walker had joined along the Belfourche River in the Black Hills. Morale of the 2,000 troops was low. They were Civil War volunteers who felt they should have been discharged when the war ended in April. Before leaving Fort Laramie, soldiers of one of Walker's Kansas regiments mutinied and would not march out until artillery was trained upon them. By late August, rations for the combined columns were so short that they began slaughtering mules for meat. Scurvy broke out among the men. Because of a shortage of grass and water, their mounts grew weaker and weaker. With men and horses in such condition, neither Cole nor Walker had any desire to press a fight with Indians. Their only objective was to reach the Rosebud for the rendezvous with General Connor. As for the Indians, there were thousands of them in the sacred places of Pahasapa, the Black Hills. It was summer, the time for communing with the Great Spirit, for beseeching his pity and seeking visions. Members of all the tribes were there at the center of the world, singly or in small bands, engaged in these religious ceremonies. They watched the dust streamers of 2,000 soldiers and their horses and wagons, and hated them for their desecration of Pahasapa, from where the hoop of the world bent to the four directions. But no war parties were formed, and the Indians kept away from the noisy, dusty column. On August 28th, when Cole and Walker reached the Powder, they sent scouts to the Tongue and Rosebud to find General Connor, but he was still far to the south that day, preparing to destroy Black Bear's Arapaho village. After their scouts returned to camp without finding any trace of Connor, the two commanders put their men on half rations and decided to start moving south before starvation brought disaster. During the few days that the soldiers were camped there on the Powder, where it curved north toward the Yellowstone, bands of Hunkpapa and Minneconjou Sioux were following their trail out of the Black Hills. By September 1st, the trackers numbered nearly 400 warriors. With them was the Hunkpapa leader, Sitting Bull, who, 2 years before at the Crow Creek camp of the exiled Santees from Minnesota, had sworn that he would fight if necessary to save the buffalo country from land-hungry white men. When the Sioux war party discovered the soldiers camped in timber along the Powder, several of the young men wanted to ride in under a truce flag and see if they could persuade the bluecoats to give them tobacco and sugar as peace offerings. Sitting Bull did not trust white men and was opposed to such begging, but he held back and let the others send a truce party down toward the camp. The soldiers waited until the Sioux truce party came within easy rifle range, and then fired on them, killing and wounding several of them before they could escape. On their way back to the main body of warriors, the survivors of the truce party made off with several horses from the soldiers' herd. Sitting Bull was not surprised at the way the soldiers had treated their peaceful Indian visitors. After looking at the gaunt horses taken from the soldiers' herd, he decided that 400 Sioux on fleet-footed mustangs should be an equal match for 2,000 soldiers on such half-starved army mounts. Black Moon, Swift Bear, Red Leaf, Stands Looking Back, and most of the other warriors agreed with him. Stands Looking Back had a saber that he had captured from one of General Sully's men in Dakota, and he wanted to try it against the soldiers. In pictographs that Sitting Bull drew later for his autobiography, he showed himself on that day wearing beaded leggings and a fur cap with ear flaps. He was armed with a single-shot muzzleloader, a bow and quiver, and carried his Thunderbird shield. Riding down to the camp single file, the Sioux encircled the soldiers guarding the horse herd and began picking them off one by one until a company of cavalrymen came charging up the bank of the Powder. The Sioux quickly withdrew on their fast ponies, keeping out of range until the bluecoats' bony mounts began to falter. Then they turned on their pursuers, Stands Looking Back in the lead. brandishing his saber and riding right in until he knocked a soldier off his horse. Stans, looking back, then wheeled his pony and dashed safely away, yelling with glee over his exploit. After a few minutes, the soldiers reformed, and at the sound of a bugle came charging after the Sioux again. Once more, the swift mustangs of the Sioux took them out of range, the Indians scattering until the frustrated soldiers came to a halt. This time, the Sioux struck from all sides, racing in among the soldiers and knocking them off their horses. Sitting Bull captured a black stallion, afterward making a pictograph of the event for his autobiography. Alarmed by the Indian attack, the Eagle Chiefs, Cole and Walker, formed their columns for a forced march southward along the Powder. For a few days, the Sioux followed the soldiers, scaring them by appearing suddenly on ridgetops or making little forays against the rearguard. Sitting Bull and the other leaders laughed at how frightened the Bluecoats became, bunching up all the time and looking over their shoulders and always hurrying, hurrying, trying to get away from them. When the big sleet storm came, the Indians took shelter for 2 days, and then one morning they heard scattered firing from the direction the soldiers had gone. The next day they found the abandoned camp with dead horses everywhere. They could see that the horses had been covered with sheets of freezing rain, and the soldiers had shot them because they could not make them go any farther. Since many of the frightened Bluecoats were now on foot, the Sioux decided to keep following them and drive them so crazy with fear they would never return to the Black Hills again. Along the way, these Hunkpapas and Minneconjous began meeting small scouting parties of Oglala Sioux and Cheyennes who were still out looking for Star Chief Connor's column. There was great excitement in these meetings. Only a few miles south was a big Cheyenne village, and as runners brought the leaders of the bands together, they began planning a big ambush for the soldiers. During that summer, Roman Nose had made many medicine fasts to obtain special protection against enemies. Like Red Cloud and Sitting Bull, he was determined to fight for his country, and he was also determined to win. White Bull, an old Cheyenne medicine man, advised him to go alone to a medicine lake nearby and live with the water spirits. For 4 days, Roman Nose lay on a raft in the lake without food or water, enduring the hot sun by day and thunderstorms at night. He prayed to the great medicine man and to the water spirits. After Roman Nose returned to camp, White Bull made him a protective war bonnet filled with so many eagle feathers that when he was mounted, the war bonnet trailed almost to the ground. In September, when the Cheyenne camp first heard about the soldiers fleeing south up the Powder, Roman Nose asked for the privilege of leading a charge against the Bluecoats. A day or two later, the soldiers were camped in a bend of the river, with high bluffs and thick timber on both sides. Deciding that this was an excellent place for an attack, the chiefs brought several hundred warriors into position all around the camp, and began the fight by sending small decoy parties in to draw the soldiers out of their wagon corral. But the soldiers would not come out. Now Roman Nose rode up on his white pony, his war bonnet trailing behind him, his face painted for battle. He called to the warriors not to fight singly, as they had always done, but to fight together, as the soldiers did. He told them to form a line on the open ground between the river and the bluffs. The warriors maneuvered their ponies into a line front, facing the soldiers, who were formed on foot before their wagons. Roman Nose now danced his white pony along in front of the warriors, telling them to stand fast until he had emptied the soldiers' guns. Then he slapped the pony into a run and rode straight as an arrow toward one end of the line of soldiers. When he was close enough to see their faces clearly, he turned and rode fast along the length of the soldiers' line, and they emptied their guns at him all along the way. At the end of the line, he wheeled the white pony and rode back along the soldiers' front again. "He made 3 or perhaps 4 rushes from one end of the line to the other," said George Bent. "And then his pony was shot and fell under him. On seeing this, the warriors set up a yell and charged. They attacked the troops all along the line, but could not break through anywhere." Roman Nose had lost his horse, but his protective medicine saved his life. He also learned some things that day about fighting Bluecoats, and so did Red Cloud, Sitting Bull, Dull Knife, and the other leaders. Bravery, numbers, massive charges, they all meant nothing if the warriors were armed only with bows, lances, clubs, and old trade guns of the fur trapper days. "We were now attacked from all sides, front, rear, and flanks," Colonel Walker reported, "but the Indians seemed to have but few firearms." The soldiers were armed with modern Civil War rifles and had the support of howitzers. For several days after the fight, which would be remembered by the Indians as Roman Nose's fight, the Cheyennes and Sioux continued to harass and punish the soldiers. The Bluecoats were now barefoot and in rags, and had nothing left to eat but their bony horses, which they devoured raw because they were too pressed to build fires. At last,